From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The real powers that be in this country are accountable to no one. The American people have a right to know who they are.
The buying of the president, 2004. Who's really bankrolling President Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they expect in return? Then protests around the country.
This is Kate Bergen. I'm calling from downtown Los Angeles, where I'm hanging off the side of a 32-story building called the Transamerica Building. I'm here with Hayden Llewellyn, and we've just hung a banner off the building that says, Ford holding America hostage to oil.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. White House officials are saying President Bush will propose next week to build a permanent inhabited base on the moon to eventually send humans to the planet Mars. The New York Times reports the announcement is intended to help portray Bush as a, quote, inspirational leader whose vision goes beyond terrorism and tax cuts. Bush's father, the country's 41st president, made a similar proposal in 1989, but it went nowhere. Bush Sr. called for the establishment of a base on the moon and an expedition to be sent to Mars as the beginning of, quote, the permanent settlement of space. The New York Post reports a permanent moon base would be used in part to test military rockets. The last manned mission to the moon was in 1972. In order to send humans to Mars, the country will have to develop new methods of propulsion and electricity generation, as well as a way to protect astronauts from large radiation doses. It's unclear how the government, which is facing record deficits, would be able to pay to develop the new technology. General Secretary of State Colin Powell met with reporters Thursday and for the first time admitted he'd never seen definitive evidence that linked Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda. Powell said, quote, I have not seen smoking gun concrete evidence about the connection. Powell went on to defend the invasion. But a year ago at the UN Security Council, Powell said there was a, quote, sinister nexus between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Powell told the UN, quote, Iraqi officials deny accusations of ties with al-Qaeda. These denials are simply not credible, he said. In Iraq, the death toll in Thursday's U.S. Black Hawk helicopter crash near Fallujah has risen to 9. The Pentagon has so far declined to say what caused the attack, but witnesses reportedly said the helicopter was hit by a missile. Also yesterday, a military transport plane carrying 60 people was forced to land in Baghdad after it was hit with a surface-to-air missile. And in Baghdad today, the Hotel Al-Hayat that houses foreign companies came under attack by rocket-propelled grenades. Meanwhile, in Tikrit, hundreds of U.S. soldiers backed by warplanes raided Saddam Hussein's hometown Thursday. 30 Iraqis were detained. Some were arrested after being pulled from their homes, blindfolded and handcuffed. At least 5 people have died in the Sunni town of Bakuba, north of Baghdad, after a bomb went off during Friday prayers. Dozens were injured in the blast. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. has struck a deal with Turkey to allow U.S. forces occupying Iraq to start using the Incirlik Air Base. Before the invasion of Iraq, Turkey refused to allow the U.S. to use any of the American bases in the country to wage attacks. In Haiti, opponents of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide have launched a 2-day general strike that has shut down most businesses in Port-au-Prince. Striking workers are calling for Aristide to resign. Among the groups backing the strike is the Chamber of Commerce. The Food and Drug Administration has rejected an effort by a private company to resume the sale of silicone breast implants, which have been banned for over 10 years. The rejection came even though the FDA Advisory Committee had voted 9-6 in October to approve the implants for cosmetic use. A new study in the journal Science is warning people against eating much farm-raised salmon because the fish contains much higher levels of carcinogens than wild-fished salmon. The FDA said people's diets shouldn't change. And in New Jersey, the state Senate voted 23-9 Thursday to recognize same-sex couples. Governor James McGreevy is expected to sign the legislation, which will make New Jersey the fifth state to recognize domestic partnership in some form. Democratic presidential candidate Richard Gephardt's manager accused Howard Dean's presidential campaign of planning to sneak non-Iowans into the state's caucuses to pose as state residents and support Dean. Dean's campaign manager denied the charge. Meanwhile, the Dean campaign in Iowa has fired two workers who are accused of trying to infiltrate John Kerry's campaign. A leading poll in New Hampshire has found that General Wesley Clark has now moved into second place in that state's primary, edging out John Kerry, who's a senator from neighboring Massachusetts. Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, remains in first place. Meanwhile, a major national poll has found Dean and Clark are now in a statistical dead heat. Meanwhile, pop star Madonna has written an open letter on her website urging her fans to back General Wesley Clark for president. Madonna has introduced Clark by filmmaker Michael Moore. The New York Times reports Clark is using Madonna's support as part of an effort to win more votes for women. From women, as part of his effort, the general has discarded his regular navy blue suit, red tie, and loafers for Argyle sweaters, corduroys, and duck boots.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Money, the flying lizards here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and that's what we'll be talking about today, money and politics. This from today's New York Times. A new study released Thursday shows employees and political action committees of brokerages, banks, and credit companies make up six of President Bush's top 10 career contributors, a clear indicator of his increasing support from the financial sector. In a similar study during the 2000 election, no major financial services firms were among the top 10. The study was conducted by the Nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity and published as a book, The Buying of the President 2004. We're now joined by the author of the book and the head of the Center for Public Integrity, Charles Lewis. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Well, has the Democratic candidate for president been chosen at this point?
Well, no. It's starting to coalesce a bit, although it's getting complicated. But there is a dirty little secret in American politics. The presidential candidate who raises the most money the year before the election gets the nomination every time since 1976. And based on that, the coalescing of funds have gone around Dean, who raised $40 million, compared to the $130 million that Bush raised, doubling his own record-shattering 99 total. But now Clark is surging, apparently, and I guess we can get into all that. But the money is circling, and whenever you get up in those stratospheres, you're going to be taking money not from backyard barbecues and those kinds of places. You're going to be taking money from people that want something. And so that person theoretically has been chosen. We'll see if it holds the next several months.
Well, today we're going to look at some questions like which candidate was paid by a pharmaceutical firm to give speeches while running for the Senate, who turned the Homeland Security Act into a bonanza for the biotech industry, who's the go-to guy for the insurance industry. But I want to start going back one election, McCain versus Bush. You talk extensively about this, and particularly interesting since McCain is also known as being one half of the McCain-Feingold bill that deals with campaign finance. But talk about President Bush's rise to power and his contributors.
Well, you know, this is a story just in another stratosphere. We've never seen anything like this. This is a fellow who runs for president in 99, had been an elected official for 5 or 6 years in the United States, and he raises almost three times more than any presidential candidate in U.S. history. Why? How? He had an extensive bundling network involving hundreds and even thousands of people who not only would give checks, the Pioneer system, the Pioneers would have to raise at least $100,000, but the insidious part of the Pioneer thing is that every check would be numbered so that every industry would get credit for the cash. And new documents that have come out show letters where they want to make sure they get credit. Now, why do they want credit? Gosh, I wonder. But anyway, so he gets the money. He starts to rise. But then a stunning thing happens. McCain beats him in New Hampshire. No one saw that one coming, including Karl Rove, by the way. McCain wins by 19 points. It was not even close. They go into South Carolina as the next primary back in 2000. And the entire Republican establishment and moneyed interest all coalesce into South Carolina. The head of the Team 100 said, if you want to see soft money continue in American politics, you better get off your duff and get out there. And so the reason I focused heavily on South Carolina is the unaccountability of what happened. McCain was mugged. Through emails and leaflet drops and phone banking and all kinds of slightly under the radar for the media stuff, McCain was outspent by 5-1 at least by Bush, and another millions and millions of dollars spent by half a dozen to a dozen quote unquote independent groups, all of whom seemed to like George Bush. And basically smeared him. I mean, said that his wife was a drug addict and that they had a black baby and all just the most spurious stuff you can imagine to try to upset South Carolina voters. And at the end of the day, Bush wins, and they think the reformer, he had a phrase, the reformer with results, they felt that the reformer actually was Bush because they'd seen all these ads about being a reformer with results. Bush had never reformed anything regarding politics in Texas and was, in fact, against campaign finance reform. But the facts and the truth were rendered irrelevant.
In fact, he made campaign finance reform a major issue.
Well, exactly.
When he was in South Carolina, an issue I believe you said he had never raised.
Right. He had had political laryngitis in his career until that moment. And his proposal, it was like a 5-page proposal, like a day before a debate. Was a non-existent proposal.
But you also talk there, and when talking about the Pioneers, the name of the Bush campaign for the highest contributors, about the significance of Enron. And when it came to South Carolina, the allegation that, and this is all too common in politics, so the companies making hidden contributions by putting campaigners on their payroll for a particular candidate. Can you talk about Ralph Reed?
Sure. Ralph Reed, who lives in Georgia and has a company called Century Strategies, contacted hundreds of thousands of voters. This was reported at the time. I'm not suggesting I did this. Rick Burke of the New York Times did a story that Enron had Ralph Reed, the former head of the Christian Coalition, on their payroll, and they did not want the public or the media to know that this right-wing conservative who is inflammatory in some circles in the U.S. was on the Bush payroll, so they put him on the Enron payroll as a lobbyist. Now, of course, Rove and Reed hotly denied it, but it was on page one of the New York Times a few years ago. So Reed, and what's particularly frustrating is what happened with this under-the-radar spurious stuff that happens against McCain happens 2 years later with Max Cleland, a guy who, as McCain put it, left three limbs on the battlefield but they had ads comparing him with picturing him with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, and questioning his patriotism. And this was all done by Ralph Reed and others and outside groups that were not part of the party officially and not part of the campaign against Cleland in that case. So, I mean, what I'm interested in is what's happened to American politics. We don't even know who's out there anymore doing anything. It's very hard to track these people.
Well, you say that there was a very systematic approach to raising money with the pioneers, everything,
right.
The marking of the checks, the credit going to the industry. So where are those records?
Well, that's the other part. Strangely, they can't account for $60 million that they raised. I can't quite produce those records. I'd made a joke in the book and said it's like the dog ate my homework. I mean, the excuses they have given in depositions. There's litigation that ensued because of the Supreme Court case that was recently decided, the McCain-Feingold case. And so under oath, the head of the pioneers and all these people said, well, gosh, we just can't find these records. And, it doesn't sound a whole terrifically credible, obviously.
But they don't have to. They don't legally have to hand over the information about who was contributing money?
They have to hand over. The contributors themselves are disclosed. But how you got there and what you did, in this instance, this is a discovery thing in a legal case. And now that the case has been decided by the Supreme Court, I'm sure all these things will be rendered moot. And so we'll probably never know, at least anytime soon that I can see. So they're essentially stonewalling or saying they don't have it, however you want to interpret it.
It's interesting. A lot of people will remember the Lincoln bedroom and President Clinton and the Lincoln bedroom for sale or for rent,
right.
For reservation overnight to the highest donors. You talk about Governor Bush in Texas,
right.
Before he was president, and his own little White House there and who,
right.
Got to sleep over.
Well, that's right. He had about 60 big funders sleep over. There's something that the national media and the public, I think, don't fully appreciate. Bush was planning to run for 2 or 3 years. He was flying people into Texas to tutor him. He was bringing in funders to gear up the campaign and planning the pioneer system. And the funders were sleeping overnight in the governor's mansion. And what's deceptive about that is when he announces his candidacy in March of 99, he bursts out and within 3 months raises $37 million, which has never at that point had never happened in American politics. And so all the other Republicans and the media all gushed over, my God, he's so popular, everyone's swarming to him. He clearly, as far as I can tell, had been laying the groundwork for 2 years. And when do you start announcing your campaign, and when did it officially begin? Is it the day you file your papers, or is it the day you start collecting checks? And there was clearly a lot of orchestration going on here that's not been fully ever laid out, and it's pretty interesting, I think.
We're talking to Charles Lewis. He is author of, along with his staff at the Center for Public Integrity, The Buying of the President 2004, who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they expect in return. Now the biggest money for Bush, where is it coming from?
Well, it's coming from the financial sector, as you just noted from the Times this morning. 6 out of 10 of his top career patrons are from the financial district. But the issue with Bush is he's an incumbent president. He's obviously friendly to the business community, and that means people are going crazy. I mean, he's gone from $67 million that he raised in '99 as a challenger to $130 million. 4 years later. He's expanding his financial base, and clearly there are companies and industries all over America that are very happy with Mr. Bush and his policies. And so it's not just the financial sector. Obviously, it's from the mining companies, the pharmaceutical industry. Back in 1992, the pharmaceutical companies, the richest, most profitable industry in America, gave evenly to both parties. Now they give between 80% and 90% to the Republicans because, for the first time in half a century, the Republicans control the entire, with a capital E, federal government. And so what's happening is money is following power, which frequently happens when you track money in a substantial, huge way. So the fact that it's not just Bush in the White House, it's across the board, and these companies now see this is a spectacular moment for them, a bonanza. They're not only giving the money, they're writing the bills. And look out. And that's what's happening.
Not in their wildest dreams did the mining industry imagine that a kindred soul, hell, one of their own lobbyists, would become chair of the Republican Party.
Well, that's right. Mark Roscoe was a mining lobbyist. He is now, by the way, a lobbyist helping companies get Homeland Security contracts after he's left. And a new lobbyist, Mr. Gillespie, is now. So the corporate community has embraced, this administration. Maybe that's probably not news to anyone, but what we do is we show how they've embraced it, how much money each sector has provided, and we get into a lot of detail about who got what policies have changed. Obviously, the environment, a lot of things have changed. It's my favorite part about the Bush chapter is the Cheney letter. I don't know if you saw that. But the fact that...
Hold it for one minute.
Sure.
Stations are going to break to identify themselves, and we'll be back with Charles Lewis, author of The Buying of the President 2004, in a minute. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the buying of the president 2004, who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they expect in return. Our guest, Charles Lewis, who is author of the report, longtime reporter who decided to start a nonprofit to really do the kinds of investigations that the mainstream media rarely does. The Cheney letter.
We did 200 Freedom of Information Act requests, which is a record for us at the center. We do them occasionally, but never like that. And we found a letter that Dick Cheney, as CEO of Halliburton, sent to Vice President Al Gore. So right off the bat, that's sort of an unusual letter to find. And we nothing gets by us. We instantly realized this is intriguing. The letter basically urged the Vice President to relax or eliminate this. There was a current proposed policy to increase environmental regulation, essentially, regarding clean air and other matters. And he complained about the impact that this legislative initiative or regulatory initiative would have on his industry and his company. And then he closed the letter saying, whatever you do, it should be in a clear and open debate in the public. This obviously is fascinating for several reasons. From an environmental standpoint, looking at what happened under Bush Cheney in the first 3 years with the environment, it shows what everyone has suspected. You have two people from the oil industry with basic hostility towards most of the environmental standards in this country. And, of course, they're getting huge amounts of money from all the industries, the polluters and the mining industries and all those people. And so that letter kind of confirms, if you had any doubt, where he's coming from. It's in black and white in his own on his own stationery. The real delicious irony, of course, is that he wants a clear and open debate, given that he didn't want any of the meetings by the energy executives in America who have been secretly meeting with them to plan their policies. And he's gone to court to prevent any access to information about just who was in the meetings. That's all that the litigation is about. It's not really about much more than that. It's just people just want to know it's government property, public policies. Wouldn't it be nice to know who these people are who are meeting? Of course, no environmental groups were invited or included in any substantive way. So the letter is a snapshot, in many ways a metaphor, to me at least, for all the things I've been hearing and reading and noticing the last 3 years. And so that's on our site. We actually have that letter up somewhere.
Okay, well, Charles Lewis, a quick test. Which candidate was paid by the pharmaceutical firm by a pharmaceutical firm to give speeches while running for the Senate?
That was Carol Moseley Braun.
Who turned the Homeland Security Act into a bonanza for the biotech industry?
I guess that's Lieberman. There are several people friendly to that industry.
Which candidate proposed 32 separate tax breaks for big business that support his campaign?
Well, that's got to be Bush.
And who is the go-to guy for the insurance industry?
Well, that would be Senator Lieberman from Connecticut.
Let's take on the Democrats right now and look at who is funding them. Let's begin with Howard Dean.
Sure.
Why don't we go in alphabetical order? Wesley Clark. Yeah.
Well, Wesley Clark, we didn't have any career patrons because he announced September 17th, and we'd actually turned in the manuscript. He has since raised about $13 million, so we're watching it, but we're going to have to wait a few weeks to figure that out. The most interesting thing about Clark that we found is that he was a registered lobbyist at the time he announced his candidacy for a company called Axiom, trying to get government contracts. And so while he was an analyst on CNN, and during the Iraq war, he was trying to get Homeland Security and airport security and all kinds of other government contracts, and he including reportedly met with Dick Cheney in 2001 and 2002 on behalf of that company. So on one hand, he's creating a leadership committee to run for president, basically, to begin the process of that. And simultaneously, he's on the air as an expert retired general. And the other part of it is he's doing what many generals do, cashing in and helping a company get contracts. And it's a part that's not in the resume ads right now in Iowa.
Howard Dean?
Vermont's a kind of a funny state because they have limits on contributions of $400. All the Democratic numbers are approximately, a tenth of Bush's numbers, but particularly so in Vermont. Even after 11 years as governor, his highest contributor is, you know, 60,000 or something like that. He's got money from some of the telecom companies and things. The most interesting thing we found about him was he had helped. There was a utility deregulation in Vermont, and he basically assisted the utility industry in a way that infuriated many, many ratepayers and may saddle them with hundreds of millions of dollars in higher rates. And one of his chief of staff went to work as a lobbyist and a top person for the leading utility. And that's not something you see in the ads either, and it's just interesting. He also was not – we all know that he's had an issue about his gubernatorial papers being opened up, but he also in 11 years did not open up any did not have disclosure for himself and his own assets, which are nearly $4 million, or any state legislator or himself and the lieutenant governor. Vermont has the worst disclosure in America. Vermont and two others have no disclosure for personal assets of its senior folks. Not only did Dean try to improve it or reform it or change it, he did not endorse legislative initiatives to try to reform it.
What does it mean, the governor's papers? What's in these papers?
Well, that I don't know. I would dearly love to read the papers. I mean, in a way, it's unclear. Is it correspondence from supporters? Is it memos from his staff about, I'd like to run for president? I don't think anyone really knows what's in those documents. We know Dean has portrayed it as a proprietary thing for people in their personal privacy who contacted him. But it has certainly given the Republicans and the Republican National Committee an issue to actually portray themselves as more open than Howard Dean, which has some amusing ironies, to say the
and
least.
And certainly a campaign changes as someone becomes as successful as Dean has become, starting on the Internet, getting the small amounts of money. And then when the establishment sees that he is surging ahead, a whole new group starts to give money. What has been the transformation of that campaign? How has the nature of where the money comes from changed?
Well, the nature is that a lot of big companies that maybe have never even visited Vermont are giving tons of money. And there are telecom companies. There's AOL, Time Warner. A lot of them are embracing Dean now and the flooding the zone, so to speak, with their cash. The part that we have to watch now, I have to tell you that because we've tracked his numbers in the first 6 months of the year, we now have the third quarter numbers up on our site, but we're going to see more of this. You look at his donors, you have Howard Dean's campaign staff was the third highest donor patron for his career. That shows you how anemic the numbers are. His third highest patron through June was $15,000 from all those folks. AOL Time Warner is his top donor, and you have Microsoft now coming in there, and Goldman Sachs, and IBM, and then, of course, you have some union support, United Food and Commercial Workers. But what you're going to see now is more, you know, now that he's up to $40 million, the numbers are going to get more corporate over time. It's just inevitable because they're worried that he might actually be the nominee, and some, but in their way of thinking, some fluke may happen and he might actually become president. They better make sure they have an in with the next president. So you're going to see money flow to him more and more. Obviously, everyone's waiting for Iowa to see what happens in New Hampshire, and it does relate directly to what happens in those states, what the money flow will be in the next few weeks.
John Edwards.
Well, John Edwards, nothing earth-shaking to report except that 22 of his top 25 career patrons are law firms. And he's already been sort of perceived as almost entirely having funding from the trial lawyers. And the question for him all along was, could he expand his base beyond trial lawyers? And there's not substantial evidence that he has done that, to be honest.
People just talk about trial lawyers, like
right.
Bush Sr.
Sure.
talked
sure.
about the ACLU.
Right.
What do trial lawyers mean? I mean, what interest does that represent?
Well, no. Trial lawyers are the plaintiff's bar that brings litigation against frequently product liability litigation or, you know, things, powerful folks to where there's no other recourse. I mean, that's one way of looking at trial. That's not the way that some people look at the trial lawyers, but that is what trial lawyers do. They bring lawsuits. Some people feel there's too many lawsuits, and there's a whole big issue on that. Of course, you could do five shows on it. But you know, that has a different thing to different people. And what Edwards has done, which is really interesting, is he is unabashedly a trial lawyer. He doesn't shy away from being one. In fact, he's proud that he's one, and he uses the sort of populist David and Goliath image of going into a courtroom against the suits as part of his message. And the question is, if it did resonate fully with Democratic voters, which is unclear, will it resonate with the rest of the nation? And it's no one's ever done that. This is new territory politically.
Richard Gephardt.
Well, most interesting about Gephardt, maybe not surprising to some, but to the nation, it's just getting acquainted with him, it's relevant information. His top donor is Anheuser-Busch, which gave over $500,000. Anheuser-Busch, of course, is based in St. Louis. On at least five occasions, Gephardt tried to and successfully help the alcohol industry avoid being taxed, including a fairly famous instance back in the mid-90s on Air Force One with Bill Clinton during the health care situation, where, you know, the reform legislation. He wanted to make sure you can tax tobacco, but don't do it for alcohol. And Clinton essentially agreed with him and backed off.
In the New York Times today, in their piece on your book, they end with a spokesperson for Gephardt saying that the congressman was representing the needs of a large employer in his district. It makes sense that a hometown company would have a good relationship with their member of Congress, Eric Smith said about Anheuser-Busch.
Well, no, you know what? I agree with him. That's fair. A member of Congress is supposed to represent their constituents, and a big employer and a big company in their district, they do have to pay attention to that. However, if I'm a voter watching someone run for president, I want to know who their patrons are. I want to know who's behind them. I want to know who their friends are, and I want to know who they're going to reward when they get into power. It's that simple. And, you know, and unfortunately, we have a commercial democracy, a pay-to-play process where everyone has alliances with vested interests, whether it's business or labor, whatever the groups are. And one of the ways to find out, we have a motto at the center, watch what they do, not what they say. Ignore all the ads, ignore all the speeches. Just see who's behind these guys, and you'll learn a lot real fast. And I think that's relevant data. And, you know, it's not illegal taking money from Anheuser-Busch, but don't the voters all over America, not just in St. Louis, have a right to know that that's his best friend in the world?
Senator John Kerry.
Kerry, you know, is a very interesting guy with three terms in the Senate. What we found that I was interested in, the top patron is a law firm, Mintz Levin, in Boston. where his brother works, and they've given something like $222,000 over his Senate career. That is one of the leading telecommunication firms in America. Kerry sits on a committee that has oversight over the telecom industry, but also the Federal Communication Commission that regulates the telecom industry. And on a number of occasions, he has sort of done the bidding of certain companies that are represented by that firm. And we actually did a report separate, a breakout-type report on our website back in the spring, and we elaborate further in the book about this relationship. It's not the only relationship. He has other patrons, but that was his top patron, and that was something that sort of jumped out.
Hmm. Dennis Kucinich, the Ohio congressman.
Kucinich is the most quintessential Democratic candidate if you look at his donors and the perceptions we have as Americans of their donor base. Nine out of his top 10 patrons are unions, and the other one is the Trial Lawyer Association. The numbers are anemic. There's not much money there. He's done things, you know, obviously to help labor, and big surprise because of when you have that much concentration from nine of your top 10, you clearly, if there's one labor candidate, pure labor candidate at the highest levels of your patron list, it's Mr. Kucinich.
Senator Joseph Lieberman.
Well, Senator Lieberman is a complex case because he's sort of a new way Democrat. He has reached out aggressively throughout his career to basically the business community. So his numbers are he has funding mechanisms, fundraising network outside his own campaign committee, by the way, which we talk about in the book. But listen to his top donors: Citigroup, Hartford Financial, Chase Enterprises, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Credit Suisse, heavy financial folks from the New York, Connecticut area, and insurance interests, which are also important in Connecticut. He has helped a number of these companies. I mean, remember, it was Lieberman who helped the accountants change their standards and helped. We had an Enron scandal because partly no one was watching the store in terms of auditing. And then when Enron broke, Lieberman was shocked that we have this scandal and how could this happen. And Lieberman has been very helpful to these, to accounting companies, to insurance companies. We have a specific instance also with biotech companies that he's close to. And, you know, again, all these relationships are very elaborately laid out.
Explain the biotech connection.
The biotech connection is, these things are complicated. Hold on a second. The biotech connection is...
We're talking to Charles Lewis, who is author of The Buying of the President 2004, who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they expect in return. Charles Lewis was a longtime reporter, but now goes more deeply into issues as head of this nonprofit that looks into moneyed interests, money connections to politics.
Right. Basically, what he did is he took hundreds of thousands of dollars from the biotech industry and from several of their companies, and he hired their top lobbyists on his staff, and he then co-sponsored bills that they wanted. To get a lot more detail, I would recommend reading the chapter for all listeners and viewers.
As we move down the alphabetical list, Carol Moseley Braun.
Well, Carol Moseley Braun is the person who gave speeches. I mentioned GlaxoWelcome paid her $20,000, which is one-third of her income, the year she was a candidate. And there was a Senate ban on speech honoraria. In other words, they couldn't receive it. But she was a senator-elect, not a senator. So weeks before taking the oath. So there is a pattern with her of repeatedly poor judgment on ethical matters where she was under a cloud, under scandals, under investigations. There was problems with her staff and her money being spent by her Senate office. So there are a lot of things involving the conduct while in office involving money that were very, very interesting. But, you know, she embraced GlaxoWelcome back to them, pharmaceutical industry. A lot of the powerful corporate interests were close to her in her short time in the Senate.
The Reverend Al Sharpton.
Well, Al Sharpton is, we could talk for a long time. He's the most interesting and multi-textured in terms of things we found. Obviously a controversial figure in lots of ways. Most interesting is the commingling of nonprofit money with personal money. Strange things happening, like records being required by the IRS, and there's a fire, and there's no records provided. And, you know, he's the only candidate that's been indicted multiple times. I mean, he is a very interesting guy, and when you read it, it's probably the most fun to read chapter in the book. And you know, Sharpton is ahead of Kerry in the national polls. I don't mean to make any aspersions about the level of his candidacy, but. But in terms of his background, this is not what you would call a typical major candidate background in terms of scrapes with problems and issues. He claims he has no assets except his ring and his watch because he's been under so much litigation, and that his suits he wears are borrowed. And so when you read stuff like that, you're like, what? I mean, it's just too interesting. So I could talk for a long time about him. I find him very interesting.
What did you make of Ted Koppel's questioning of Kucinich, Mosley, Braun, and Sharpton, saying, basically asking if they're running vanity campaigns, that defining the effectiveness of their campaign to do with the money that they have raised, and then ABC pulling their reporters from their campaigns right after that debate?
Well, no, I think that they are saying things in the campaign that no one else is saying, and I think it's very important for their voices to be heard. And we do have a problem where we have candidates that are getting matching funds, but they desperately need the matching funds because they were never prolific fundraisers in their careers, that are then discounted by the media as not being players because they don't have money. And it's sort of a vicious cycle here. So then we'll discount them further and then just have the moneyed folks who are considered important.
And yet, as you said, even polling behind them in the national polls. Finally, the candidates we didn't talk about were the two parties, the Republican and Democratic parties, because their money is often some of these candidates' money.
Well, the two, we have a big chapter on the parties, and we have the top 50 patrons for both parties. Philip Morris is the top patron for the Republican Party. The tobacco companies, three of the top 10 are tobacco companies for the Republican Party. But, you have a case of a very robust corporate presence, not just tobacco. Over on the Democratic side, labor unions are all over the top 10. I believe six of the top 10 are labor unions. And the number one donor for the Democratic Party in the last 10 years, but actually probably the last 20 years, is the American Federation of State and County and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, which has also given heavily to the 527s, $36 million just to 527s, these secret, mysterious organizations, not counting campaigns and parties. So you do see that doesn't mean there's not a strong corporate presence also with the Democratic Party. There is, but obviously not to the extent of the Republicans, and the numbers are always lower.
Well, Charles Lewis, thank you for taking us on this money journey through the candidates' coffers, from President Bush to the Democratic candidates. Charles Lewis is head of the Center for Public Integrity, and they have published The Buying of the President 2004, Who's Really Bankrolling Bush and His Democratic Challengers, and What They Expect in Return. Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at protests around the country. Stay with us.
Some people really need it. Just a million dollar do things.
for the Love of Money. The OJ is here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today in this last segment, we're going to talk about protests around the country. On Thursday, human rights activists, environmentalists, rappelled down a 32-story skyscraper near the Los Angeles Auto Show. We got a call from Kate Berrigan, who was on the side of the building yesterday in a protest organized by Global Exchange and the Rainforest Action Network.
This is Kate Berrigan. I'm calling from downtown Los Angeles, where I'm hanging off the side of a 32-story building called the Transamerica Building. I'm here with Hayden Llewellyn, and we've just hung a banner off the building that says, "Ford holding America hostage to oil." And the reason we're doing that with Rainforest Action Network and Global Exchange is that two blocks away in the convention center here, the LA Auto Show is happening. And we really want to be encouraging Ford right now to pursue fuel efficiency. Ford is the only car company that doesn't have a hybrid in progress. And the average Ford vehicle, or the typical Ford vehicle on the road right now, gets fewer miles per gallon than the Model T did 80 years ago. So we really just want to encourage Ford to pursue that technology, which already exists, and to be the environmental car company that they say they are.
Can you describe what you mean when you say you're hanging off a building?
Well, Hayden and I each have a rope set up that are anchored on the roof, and we have rappel systems locked into there, as well as systems to go up. And we rappelled down with the banner and tied it off to the building at the top and the middle, and we're hanging out here right now at the bottom. Yeah, the banner says Ford, that's the Ford logo, holding America hostage to oil. And then there's a picture of the Statue of Liberty being held up by a gas nozzle. And then it has Rainforest Action Network and Global Exchange's logos at the bottom. And it says jumpstartford.com, which is the name of the campaign.
How long have you been hanging there, and are there people there who are trying to get you down?
Yeah, I think we've been up here about an hour, something like that, maybe a little longer. I've sort of lost track of time. But, yeah, there's maybe 20 fire department vehicles down on the ground, several police cruisers, and my understanding is that there's also urban response teams, fire department, police department up on the roof, and they're encouraging us to come down soon. Or come up.
So what are you going to do?
We're unhooking our systems right now. We're going to make our way up to the top of the banner, unhook that, and then make our way down to the bottom of the building, which is probably about another 17 stories or so from where we are right now.
Kate Berrigan speaking to us as she was rappelling a skyscraper near the Los Angeles Auto Show, unveiling a large banner reading "Ford holding America hostage to oil" in a protest organized by Global Exchange and the Rainforest Action Network. As we turn now from Los Angeles to upstate New York in Ithaca, four teenagers scheduled to begin serving four consecutive weekends in prison today for their participation in an anti-war demonstration at a military recruitment center, December of 2002. At the time of the action, three of them were 17, one was 18. They were convicted of third-degree criminal trespass and refused to pay any fines for their action. A judge has issued a stay on their sentence while the four young women appeal their decision. We're joined now by Anna Grady Flores, who was one of those who has been sentenced to spend her weekends in jail. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Anna.
Hi, Amy. Thank you.
First, tell us why you were protesting and what you did.
Basically, we're just the protests happened before the war started, and we were trying to protest the war and the upcoming war, and just educate our young men and women in the service that there are opportunities for them besides the military, and that we don't want them to go and die in a war that is unlawful and unneeded, and we just wanted to let them know that we didn't want them to go and fight and get sick with depleted uranium and things like that. And so there were about 300 of us that turned out that day for a silent walk through our local mall. And after that, we proceeded to another mall. After we were kicked out of that mall, We went across the street to another mall and proceeded in a die-in at one of our recruiter centers. There were 13 of us, and four of us were underage. I myself was 16, Anna was 16, Una was 17, and so was Marie. Una and Marie are my cousins. And we were able to lie there for about an hour and a half, and they eventually did arrest us and charge us with criminal trespass to third degree, which is a misdemeanor. We then eventually went to court. We were separated from the adults. The adults' charges were dropped down to a violation, and our charge was stayed at as a misdemeanor, which is a higher charge. And basically so they wouldn't have to have a jury trial for the adults, and they're not allowed to give youthful offenders a jury trial, so it wouldn't cost them any money. So.
And what was your reaction when you heard that you would have to spend these weekends in jail?
I was very surprised, because beforehand we did negotiate, the day of our sentencing, we did negotiate with the DA, and we're being offered community service of our choice and to pay a fine of our choice, but had to be to a nonprofit organization. And we thought that was great. We, you know, we were excited about that, and we decided that we wanted to work with the American Friends Service Committee, and which is the young people alternatives to the military. And we wanted to work just educating our young men and women here about different alternatives, you know, just like we said in the beginning. That's what we were there in the recruiter center for. And so the DA said that that was okay, and we needed to give us $100 to a nonprofit organization, and we agreed. But when we went into the courtroom, the judge said that that was not okay with him, and he was going to teach us a lesson, and there was he was going to... I don't know, really ridiculous, but he said that he was not accepting that, and he, and so the DA had to decide something else, and he said, okay, fine, we're going to ask for a $100 fine and a restriction order from the Military Recruiter Center.
Anna, we have 10 seconds.
Okay.
So the judge has said you have to go to jail, but now a judge has stayed this while you appeal this decision?
Exactly. We're going to court on Monday. We're not going to jail today. We were supposed to be scheduled to appear at the county jail at 6 p.m. today, but we are not, because we did schedule an appeal on Monday of this week, and we're going to appear in front of the county court next Monday.
Well, Anna Grady Flores, I want to thank you very much for being with us. As we move now down to South Carolina, I'm looking at a piece that's at Common Dreams News Center, commondreams.org, from the San Francisco Chronicle by James Bovard. This says, when President Bush travels around the United States, the Secret Service visits the location ahead of time and orders local police to set up free speech zones or protest zones where people opposed to Bush policies and sometimes sign-carrying supporters are quarantined. These zones routinely succeed in keeping protesters out of presidential sight and outside the view of the media covering the event. Well, Brett Bercy was subjected to one of these. Longtime political activist was fined $500 Tuesday after a judge found him guilty of entering such a restricted area during a presidential visit. Brett Bercy, can you tell us what you did and about this fine, about being found guilty? Where were you?
Well, the debatable issue is whether I was in a restricted zone knowingly and willfully and refused to leave. And the case that the federal government brought against me, they didn't bring charges until 5 months after the incident. I was arrested at the time for trespassing by local police. I'm more than 200 yards away from the building that Bush is in, holding a sign that says no war for oil, and I'm approached and told that I have to go to the free speech zone, which is about a half a mile away. And after arguing with them for 10 minutes, I moved further away from the building. They told me I couldn't be there. The only place I could be was the free speech zone. And the Secret Service ordered the local police to arrest me for trespassing. 5 months later, I'm indicted by the federal government under a statute that regulates presidential threats, kidnappings, and assassinations. It gives the Secret Service the authority to establish a restricted area around the president. And the judge believed the prosecution that I had the intent of being arrested and that I knew that it was a federally restricted area, though no one mentioned that at the time. And as a matter of fact, what people were saying, what the police were saying, was that I had to go to the free speech zone, and I was arrested for trespassing. So I lost the case, was fined $500. I was facing 6 months and $5,000. So the judge split the middle, trying to make everyone happy. But we're not happy. This is the first prosecution of the federal statute that empowers the Secret Service to set up these restricted zones around the president that they can keep everyone out of. And the free speech zones now are a separate matter that we've determined that the Secret Service is ordering local police to set these up, while the Secret Service's own manual on demonstrations that we got under discovery prohibits the Secret Service from segregating peaceful protesters from the general public. So we've learned a good deal about the way the Secret Service is supposed to work and the way they do work, and we want to share that with people who may have a visit from George Bush or Dick Cheney, if he ever comes out of hiding. And the Secret Service manual pages are posted on our website as midnight tonight.
And your website is?
www.sc, is in South Carolina, ProNet, is in Progressive Network, www.scpronet.com.
Finally, we're going to move now to San Francisco from South Carolina. The San Francisco Chronicle has announced it's reached a financial settlement with a former journalist it fired after he was arrested during an anti-war rally last year. We're joined on the phone by technology columnist, once technology columnist, Henry Noor. Henry Noor, can you tell us about this settlement and what happened?
Hi. It was a pretty big victory for me, I think. I didn't get the job back, but at least I made them pay a price for it. I got a financial settlement, I got my pension and some benefits, and best of all, I got to state my piece in the paper. They agreed to run a story in which I would have a couple paragraphs, and I got to explain that I was fired for my political activity and that that was clearly illegal and unfair and undemocratic. So I agreed to take the deal. I'm sorry that I didn't get the job back, in a sense. Not that I had such a burning desire to go back there, but I did want to make the point that their behavior was illegal. The problem was that they...
We have 10 seconds.
Okay, they essentially said that if I did get a reinstatement order, they would never let me write again with a byline. I'd be buried somewhere.
Well...
That was not a very attractive prospect. So and the counteroffer was, the other parts were pretty sweet, so I took it.
Well, Henry Noor, now former San Francisco Chronicle reporter. And that does it for today's program. By the way, I want to welcome Milwaukee Public Access TV, MATA, who's just starting to broadcast Democracy Now! Today and heading up to Vermont next Friday night at the Eclipse Theater in Waitsfield for the film festival there. We'll be talking about independent media in a time of war. If you want to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.